Psalms of orientation, psalms of disorientation, and psalms of new orientation. And let's start with psalms of orientation. And psalms of orientation are this kind of place where, in a variety of ways, they articulate joy, delight, goodness, coherence, reliability of God, God's creation, God's governing law. Everything fits together as it should be. And this is a world without fear. And, so Psalm 8 would be an example of this. And what I'd like to do is read this together, because it's a psalm of praise. And, I get very much the sense that this is a congregational type psalm or poem. So if you would read the lines with the C, the little bolder text, then I will read the lines with the L. Lord, our Lord, you made your glory higher than the heavens. When I look up at your skies, you've let them rule over your handiwork, putting everything under their feet, all sheep and all cattle, the wild animals too, the birds in the sky, the fish of the ocean, everything that travels the pathways of the sea. Lord, our Lord.
Yeah.
It's that psalm that just describes everything fitting together. There's this harmony. Everything's nicely ordered. For those of us that like control, this feels really comfortable. But we also know that this psalm often does not describe the reality of life. Life is not always a place of well-being. My rejection letter put me into that place of disorientation. And disorientation can be a harsh, isolating, painful, uncertain, fearful place. And this is what psalms of disorientation describe. They arise out of death, failed dreams, disorder, realities that contradict God's promises. Psalm 13 is one such example. And I'm going to read this one just because I want to try to... I'm not a dramatic voice, but I thought I'd try to put some drama to this. How long, Lord? Will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I wrestle with my thoughts and day after day have sorrow in my heart? How long will my enemy triumph over me? Look on me and answer, Lord my God. Give light to my eyes, or I will sleep in death. And my enemy will say, I have overcome him, and my foes will rejoice when I fall. But I trust in your unfailing love. My heart rejoices in your salvation. I will sing the Lord's praise, for he has been good to me. My time in Rivendell stands out compared to past retreats. And for a long time, I couldn't figure out why. Eventually, I think I understood why. It was because it was probably the first time I was actually emotionally honest with God, just like these psalms of disorientation. I'm pretty good at controlling my emotions, presenting a calm face. I've had people comment on how I can be so calm in the midst of the chaos. Psalms of disorientation are those places of raw emotion. And that rawness, that this kind of irreverent response to God has always bothered me. How can you talk to God like that? Where is this, how do you worship? It breaks kind of the churchy boundaries. And yet, if I consider the friends of God, people like Moses, David, Job, the prophets, I see a common element. Each one of them is emotionally honest with God. They tell it like it is, what they're feeling. Too often, I think in the church, we've heard this subtle lie that if you're feeling disorientated, it's because you're not living the victorious Christian life. Psalms of disorientation say otherwise. They say that disorientation is a part of life. It's a reminder. And it's not just the Psalms where we find that. We also have the book of Lamentations. There's the book of Job. And then we have Jesus' own words. My God, why have you forsaken me? Each of these speaks of dislocation, suffering. Perhaps in our CWGs, when we meet like this, you know, we always have songs of praise and worship. I'm wondering if we shouldn't be including Psalms of disorientation. Because the reality is that somebody here is in that place. I think one of the things about Psalms of disorientation, or those that voicing of that disorientation, is that raw emotion is actually uncomfortable to be around. We're not sure what to do with it. And I think that's probably why we don't do Psalms of disorientation on Sunday mornings, because it is uncomfortable. It feels almost irreverent. So what do you do, though, when you encounter somebody who's in that place of disorientation? How do you respond to that rawness? What you don't do is you don't give them a Bible verse cliche answer. What you need to do, actually, is listen. And I think a metaphor for listening is to think of a crucible. A crucible is a special ceramic container that holds molten metal. The molten metal doesn't damage it. And by being a good listener, you provide a crucible for them to pour their raw, hot emotions in. And that's part of the journey through the disorientation. You need somewhere to express, to feel deeply. So listening, really important part. When you do meet somebody that's in that place of disorientation, that disordered place. In my story of transition, I was intentional about being open and honest with the people where I was at. If people asked where I was at, what was going on, I would give them an honest reply instead of saying everything's okay. I also had a house church that was a safe place for me where I could be vulnerable and speak what was going on. And about a year prior, I had begun meeting with a spiritual director, and he also provided one of those crucibles that I could pour out my questions and my emotions. So this way of handling that transition contrasts to a transition several years before, 2009, 2010. In the space of 8 months, I was hit with 5 deaths in a close circle of people. And I didn't navigate that one well. The family system that I grew up in had an unspoken motto of, I'm self-sufficient and I don't show emotions. So I applied that strategy to this period of disorientation and that took me to, I think, an unhealthy place. I numbed my emotions. And part of that is a natural defense. It happens, and that's okay. It's just our way of coping with something that is overwhelming. I, however, stayed in that place. I continued to numb. I found ways to distract. And this made me emotionally unavailable for Grace, who's also going through her own grief process. The other mistake, as mentioned, I distracted myself with the pain. This was the time when we sold our business, so I bought a new mountain bike, a Whistler Blackcomb Edge card, and then took an extended summer vacation for the first time. From what I know now about losses and disorientation, I can see I was avoiding the necessary and painful work of wrestling with losses, and I expect it would not have played out well, except there was a but-then-God moment that provided a critical course correction. Places of disorientation are often places of crises because familiar reference points are gone. An existing order has become disordered. We've lost control of things. And a danger in navigating disorientation is also the temptation to try to return to what was. The Hebrews, after leaving Egypt, in their disorientation of adapting to a nomadic desert life, start having this romanticized memory of what Egypt was, a place of abundance, leeks, garlics, pots and pots of meat. For them, the psychological reality was that might have been slavery, but at least they knew the names of the streets. In the desert, there was nothing familiar. It's all new. God prevented them from returning to Egypt. He kept pushing them forward. So another reality to be aware of in this journey through disorientation is that before you can have a beginning, you have to have an ending. And it sounds so simple, but the reality is we often avoid coming to an ending. We try to postpone, avoid, duck around, keep it just in case, you know, just you keep it in your back pocket. Who knows when you might need it. We use rituals to help us mark endings. So a funeral is a ritual that helps us come to an ending. Coming face to face with a body in a casket is literally coming face to face with an ending. There's something psychological that penetrates because we're such visual people. And that's something that these rituals do. Endings take time, because there's a grieving process going on, and grieving is never simple. If you've been through, I'm sure you have all been through some kind of grief, and you know, one day you can be feeling this, the next day you can be feeling this, and it bounces around. It's not linear. It feels erratic, unpredictable. But that's part of grief, and we need to engage it. It's not something we can get over quickly or move on from. We have to actually process it, because if we don't, it will come back to bite us. And in extreme cases, it will show up as mental illness or physical illness. So we need to find ways to process that grief. So one of the things I mentioned, that the new owner of the business got himself into financial trouble and had to close the business. Based on what I'd learned about transitions at that point, I handled this transition very differently. One thing I did was I created a clear ending by helping to dismantle the laundry that our family's sweat equity had built over 23 years. This helped me grieve and come to terms with the ending as I faced memories of building up the business. In a book called Transition by William Bridges, he calls, there's this also this place of ending that he calls a neutral zone. It's kind of when the initial shock of that disorientation has kind of subsided, but you're in this, you're not sure what's happening. You know, the car's in neutral, the engine's ready, running, and you're stuck there. Nothing's moving. And again, this is one of those places that you don't want to rush, because there's internal reordering happening, even though you're not necessarily aware of it. It may feel uncomfortable because there feels like there's no progress. In a society where we keep pushing about progress, movement, forward, forward, it'll feel like you're not moving forward. That's okay. You need to sit in that place often for a while. In my neutral zone, one of the words I used for it was recalibrating, because it gave me a metaphor for what some of the work I needed to do. I'd been in this particular business for 23 years. I needed to recalibrate, retool, re-equip. Some people use words like reconciling. You need to reconcile the situation. Others use the word coming to terms with. So those are all terminologies of that neutral zone where you're kind of wondering what's next, and yet you're still dealing with what happened. And then in that neutral zone, often unexpectedly, we are surprised by a gift from God. A new coherence made present to us just when we thought all is lost. This is a new orientation. It's a but-then-God moment. In my story, this moment came about 3 months later, when by word of mouth I heard about a job in a job I'd never considered in an industry I'd never thought of, and I applied, and within days I had a job offer that I accepted. It's but then God moment. But the other level of the but then God moment is it wasn't just a job to pay bills. It was a job that fit with my skills and my value set. It gave me meaning. The Psalms that express this new orientation are often full of praise, yet often there's a stanza that references that dark time. That's important to note, because the writers don't try to hide the bad stuff in some secret closet. It's as if the trauma never happened. Instead, they acknowledge the pain, and that is important for our own health, emotionally and spiritually. Psalm 30 is an example of David's poem of new orientation. And this one I'd like to read antiphonally, so left and right. So the left side, the right side, you've got the L's and the R's, and then there's an all. So left side, would you start with feeling, please? You get a sense, a different sense from that psalm? All three of the ones that we've done, each one of them has a different tone, very different tone. And those, so psalms of orientation, disorientation, new orientation. I find Brueggemann's triad of these three orientations makes sense to me because it maps out the different emotional places of life's journey. William Bridges' book echoes this in secular terms with the explanations of ending, the neutral zone, and new beginnings. I think at least half of our house church has read William Bridges' book, Transitions. And I think I've seen how it's helped them navigate through their own transitions. It's a structure that I've put to the test several times, and in my experience, it's provided that compass to navigate. I can be in a place of orientation where life is good and ordered. Out of this perspective, it's easy to be positive and praise God, feeling like He's really close and present. Then suddenly something happens that disrupts my comfort, my order, my control, like what happened to me. And suddenly I'm disoriented in this dark valley. Eventually, after what seems like a very long time, we are surprised by grace. A new orientation takes shape. And it's in this new place that it's easy to sing the praises, the joy, feel that joy of this last psalm that we just read together. And then with time, that new orientation becomes simply orientation. Everything is ordered, structured, normal again. So it repeats. But it gives us this kind of a way to navigate. Because when you know, when you can put a label to something, it actually helps make sense of it. I'm going to shift to some contemporary language to describe this wisdom from the Psalms. And we've all heard of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. It's a result of that traumatic, destructive disorienting. I'm curious if anyone has ever heard of PTG. Post-traumatic growth. Yeah? PTG. Post-traumatic growth. It's the personal growth that comes after the trauma. It's not in the trauma, but it's after the trauma. And a couple distinctions about it. It's not a return to the previous state. That's resiliency. That's the bouncing back. Instead, it's a bouncing forward. It's a new perspective. Might be new values, a new orientation to the world. I have a friend who survived cancer. And after his fight with cancer, he changed his signature from signing his name to signing Carpe Diem, seize the day. That's an example of that bouncing forward, a new perspective. We hear a lot about PTSD and almost nothing about PTG, which is odd because PTG is way more common than the disorder. Some of the factors that contribute to PTG, I've already talked about, but here they are in a list form. Maybe some of this is maybe kind of borrowing some language from psychology, but one of the big factors is spirituality. It's why, having a why. For us as followers of Jesus, our why is Jesus, God. We believe God is in control, God is present. We understand God's love for us, and we also have prayer, our own and that of others. Feeling deeply. This is those psalms of disorientation where the emotions are just almost toxic. But it's feeling that, acknowledging it, and not burying it. Constructive disclosure. Having a group or confident that you can talk about, that will hold that crucible for you, where you can pour those hot emotions into. Also, the social supports. Church, house church, neighbors, small groups, friends, families, co-workers. That's a really critical piece as well. Another one, I think, is gratitude. You notice that even in that psalm of disorientation, the psalmist comes back and anchors to God. You know, I will praise God. It's an act of willpower, but he says that. And it begins to be this idea of finding something to be thankful for, even in the darkness, because it reminds us that God is present and that God is at work. And finally, there's acceptance of what cannot be changed. There's no point wasting energy on something that can't be changed. And I think it takes a certain amount of discernment sometimes to know what can be changed and what has to be fought to be changed. But it's one of those elements. What I find interesting about kind of this language about PTG is how much it mirrors the navigational aids of the Psalms. I don't know if the places of disorientation are God's doing. What I am confident of is that God desires and does bring good out of the broken pieces to create new orientation. It's what we call redemption, salvation. And this is our message of hope that we carry, that we see modeled in Jesus' death and resurrection. This hope is there for us as followers of Jesus. I've asked people from our house church if they would fill in some of the gaps that I've probably left in talking about this, maybe drawing from their own experience. And so I know Grace has something, a couple poems that she's written, and she'll share those with us. And then, if others from house church want to, we'll also open it up, but because this is something I think we can all learn from each other here very much. Grace. Yeah. I'll use the. Okay. Yeah, that one.
not sure if it's...
What seemed like a good idea at the time when Jim shared that he was going to be speaking about disorientation, I'm feeling my nervousness right now. My heart is pounding. Can I be vulnerable in this place? Can I share my desolation? What I need right now is actually to just take a few deep breaths. So if you'll join me in just taking a minute to take a deep breath, take about five. And in your quietness, listen to God and what He might be saying through these words that I will be sharing. God, we thank you that you are present here, that you are with us in those moments of desolation, that you are here right now beside us. Help us to hear your voice of consolation in the midst of desolation. And as I light the candle on the chair, may your presence remind us of the light on the darkness in our lives. The background to this is that the previous Friday that these two poems were written, an announcement was made on February 4th that my teaching supervisor was being let go, and I'm in a program, for some of you that don't know, called Clinical Pastoral Education, and a teaching supervisor is more than just a teacher. He's a mentor. He's someone that has shared deeply with each one of us in our class. And we had grown close to him and were surprised at this announcement that he was being let go to restructuring in his role as teaching supervisor and acute care manager. For me and my peers, it was something that we weren't prepared for. So for myself and many others, everything changed. Our teaching supervisor's last day would be the last day of our CPE unit, which was February 24th, and the announcement was made on February 4th. I was feeling the loss and wondering what my future would hold. I was devastated. All day, the Saturday after I found out, I had no energy. I was emotional and wondering what to do. And then on February 9th, Thursday, added to another snowstorm, Jim shoveled that day for about 40 minutes before we embarked on another journey to Vancouver. I reflected. And these poems are two of my reflections. So the first one is at 8:30 a.m. So Jim, can you... Oh, you've got it? Okay. And it's called The Light Through the Trees, February 9th, 8:30 a.m. This morning, on my snowy drive to work, I noticed in me desolation, uncertainty, anxiety. What will my day hold when I am in this space? Should I continue on my journey? Do I avoid the rough waters? Do I bail or stay safely on shore? Or do I stay in the rough waters in my boat with my life vest, hoping I won't get dumped? But what is certainty? Is there anything certain? Driving on Denman, I notice a panorama photo in a framing shop of a grove of trees with light shining through. Light. Hope. Walking on my favorite street towards the hospital, I notice the birds chirping, reminding me of God's presence in the midst of fear, uncertainty, desolation, anxiety. What will my day hold? Only God knows. I will trust you. I stop. I watch. I listen. I follow. Poem number 2, Light on Dark. This is written at 1 p.m., right after my lunch break. Light is known to exist by virtue of darkness. One is the chair upon which the other sits. Alan Wolfelt. Today at lunch, I sat in a weathered chair by a warm fire in a coffee shop, absorbing myself in becoming human. I am burdened with the heaviness of hellos and goodbyes, of joy and sorrow, of connection and isolation, of fairness and injustice, of being filled and emptied, of hope and hopelessness. Then, as I stand up and put on my scarf and coat, behind me, a man with graying black hair and black-rimmed glasses waits for my chair. You'll like this chair. It's warm by the fire. Not like outside, wet and cold. He responds, "You need darkness and light." I could feel the tears rising. "You are right." He says, "Someone will be in line waiting for the chair behind me." But darkness is so hard, so painful, letting go. Wondering what's next, what do I do now, without knowing what lies ahead of me? Can I trust you, God? I will trust you. All my hope is found in your love. I will trust you. All my hope is found in your love. I open the door. A robin sings in the tree. Not just the song, but the bird, reminding me of God's presence in the unknown. Thank you for listening.
For Grace, those poems that she wrote is a way of feeling deeply. One of those factors that helps us navigate through those places. Richard or Karen, John, Dorothy, Peter, Pam, and we've all journeyed through shared transitions. Please come and add.
Great. Thank you so much, Jim and Grace. I'm just going to sit down here. Great. In 2009, Karen and I were living in Ottawa, and a position opened up. I was catching cocaine smugglers for the Canadian government using math and statistics, a pretty cool job. And at the time, I was 30 years old, and a position opened up to become the executive director of the Canadian Math Society, an organization I'd been involved in For many years, ever since I was a teenager, my mentor had this position. He was retiring, and I applied for the job. Out of 20 candidates, I made the final two. So, Jim, very much like your story, and being in a tremendous position of disorientation when I learned 1 week after the final interviews took place that they took the older, more experienced, non-mathematician candidate, a steady ship to a steady hand to sail the ship, rather than the young guy perhaps a stronger upside. I remember feeling so devastated by this news. I sent an email to the 300 or so contacts I had in my Gmail, of which 90% were non-Christian, sharing my pain, my sadness, my devastation at losing my dream job, or coming in second for my dream job, and sharing a Bible, my favorite Bible verse, Jeremiah 29:11, of "For I know the plans," and I was saying, "God, I'm not really sure what you have in mind." I had seen all the doors open, and being hit with this brick wall of this news that I just never saw coming. And a month later, Karen learned of an opportunity in Japan as a university professor in Tokyo, and feeling so excited by this opportunity, she later got this position. And just before we moved to Tokyo, my boss took me out to dinner. We had a four-hour exit interview, and she asked me, "Why did you want that job with the Math Society so much?" And I told her it was because this one job would have given me the opportunity to be a champion for pure and applied math research, would have given me the opportunity to inspire innovative curriculum from coast to coast, and to share with young people the message that with inspired teaching and mentorship, anyone can succeed in math and develop the creativity, confidence, and critical thinking skills so important in life. I still remember that answer 7 years later. And she said, "Richard, why do you need that job to have that kind of impact?" I wasn't sure how to answer, but it turns out that 2 days later, when I had my last day at the Canada Border Services Agency, my five staff members bought me and Karen a ticket to the Nordic Spa, the equivalent of the Scandinav, near Ottawa. They found it. They thought, "Richard, you could learn to relax," and this was a very appropriate gift. I wonder, yeah, and it was so interesting being at the spa in Ottawa, and just relaxing as I, and a thought came to me that I never imagined, which was, I should write a book. And I had no idea what that would be and where this thought came from, but sitting in the spa one day after I left this position I had for 4 years, I felt this voice that now I finally understood was a voice from God giving me an idea as someone who last took an English class in grade 12, who had no experience with creative writing, to be able to move to Japan as an unemployed house husband to go strictly for Karen's position, but not really sure what was there for me. With no children, it doesn't take me 9 hours to do some laundry and cook one meal, so I needed 8.5 hours to do a whole bunch of other things, and it was so exciting to be able to have that opportunity to do that. So fast forward many years later, I've just now sold 1,000 copies of this novel. I remember getting an email from a grade 12 student in Iowa, a place I've never been and have no plans to ever go to, saying that a very simple story that I could write helped her understand and define clarity about what she wanted to do in her future. And I feel so grateful now, living in Squamish, to be able to work with folks like Katie and Sebastian to share and to touch people's lives in a way that I never, ever could have imagined before. And then just before I close, Karen and I were looking for a church here in Squamish. We went to many different churches. It was Andrew's dad, who is a dear friend and mentor to me, said, "Hey, why don't you come to my church?" And it was our first Sunday here. We got to hear Marilee's husband, Tim, speak and share so openly with such vulnerability. It made me realize, wow, this is totally the place for us. Later we met Grace and Jim and others to a house church that we still belong to with Peter and Pam and John and Dorothy and others. And it was this sense of community that we really felt in many ways, God saying, hey, the River Church, this is where you're going to meet people that God is going to work through remarkable women and men who are vulnerable and open and honest. And through that journey, God has used you to help us grow in our lives. So we feel so grateful for this community. And it's amazing that God has met us in places of our transition of this journey from Ottawa to Tokyo and now to Squamish. And we feel so blessed to be on this journey with each and every single one of you.
Karen, do you want to add anything? Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How about you, John, Dorothy? Okay.
I guess it's always hard when you reach my age, where do I start? Where do I end? But throughout it all, it's quite amazing what God is up to. Doesn't matter what age in life it is, because he's up to something, especially when we're in the rough waters. Then I think it's more than anything. It's not about me, it's about God and letting him do an amazing work. Just thanks be to God that he's willing or gave his life for each one of us, and especially through different events in life. And I've been through a lot of little hoops, big hoops. Some are more significant than others. But quite often, you know, I worked a lot for my own business. But you build up and you tear down. And I think that's a big metaphor in regards to our life or my life. We build up and God does the same thing. He says, what is it about? Is it about me or is it about, you know, about God? And I remember in one particular business that was in Victoria, and I started there again as my own business after having a business in Coquitlam. But it's all about building up and tearing down. And it reminds me of many times that, yeah, it's really about God. And whenever I was working in those business or that kind of occupation or whatever the occupation, it was more about bringing out God's word. How many customers can I reach today? How many... quite often I'd have music on because, you know, I had my own radio, TV, electronics business, and I could turn on the music and customers would quite often say, what's that music on for? Well, it's a good music and it's something that, it depends in what phrase I would use God, but quite often it would go into that direction if that person was willing to go in that direction. And I think in life, I think it's quite often, do I really want to go in that direction? And Jim was talking about being in one part and then being in no man's land or being all the questions in life. God takes care of us when, they're saying is, when one door closes, another window opens. And I found that, this is why I've done so many different things in life, that it's quite amazing. God has opened up so many different windows, and applying for jobs or positions and all those kind of things. It's all good, but then throughout these different kind of things, the challenges, the setbacks, and all these, did I come closer to God? And I know, thanks be to God that I did, and that now I'm here in Squamish, and I was even offered a job. Do you want to work here? You know, why aren't you applying here? So I think God, or I know God takes care of us in sickness and in health, in money or no money, that on the bottom line is that if we have God in our hearts, and I thank God for his healing power over me and carrying me through all these circumstances, and then now we're here, and we give God the praise.
Comments, questions? We're in this very comfortable semicircle here where we can engage in a conversation together about your own places of disorientation or what you think of the model.
Thank you, Grace, and Jim, for your... Hi, Grace. I want to thank you for your sharing, because I think around 3-4 weeks ago, I was up here saying about how life throws a curveball on you, and the next day, a curveball got thrown at me. Just kind of, I was thinking more of my wife at that time and the stuff she was going through in her family. And then I, for me, the work, the career thing, everything that was stable there just changed. Two people got let go announced their quitting retirement. And that put me up for a position that I thought was mine, but I didn't get it. They're bringing somebody else in. And I've been there before. And you know what? I'm okay with it. There's a peace in my heart about it. I'm right in the middle of it too, though, because the psalm where you get this disorientation is happening in my life right now. So I don't have a end to the story. I know I've been here before in different circumstances in my life. I always will say, though, yeah, I will praise you, God. I will trust you, for you have been good to me. And that, to me, has always been a fact.
You got, yeah, just use your big.
We've been talking a lot about the orientation, disorientation, reorientation, and.
Karen, yeah.
I like that a lot. And when John was talking about rebuilding, tell me again, rebuilding and tearing down and, right? Rebuilding. So I've been doing a lot of, like, in my personal life and student life, research into, like, grief and loss and nature and seasons and all this kind of stuff. And so it's actually really cool that it can all kind of come together. So in the thesis that I wrote, I talked about the symbol of the nurse log or nurse stump. Some of you know. So it's the idea that, I'll just go back a little bit. When I was at, I feel like it's a little commercial for like Bowen Island Rivendell Retreat Center, but that's where I was at. Anyway, and I was going for a walk in the woods and in a period of desolation and grief and raw emotion. Anyways, walking in the woods. And then I was like, do-do-do-do-do. And then I noticed this stump. And I was like, oh, yeah, I just relate to that stump. I feel cut off. It's like sometimes grief can feel like an amputation. I was just like, it's like your heart's amputated from your body almost. So I was just like really identifying with the stump. And then as I kept going, I noticed, hey, wait a minute. It's not just a stump. There's actually some green shoots popping up here. I'm like, what's that about? And then what's interesting is as I reflected on that more and, like, talked to people, they were like, you know, that's all part of the ecosystem, like how God made the world. It's like this tree dies and then starts to decompose and then goes into the soil and nurtures the soil. And even, like, the fungi and the creatures and the – anyway, the biologist people probably know more. But, like, it all contributes to new life. So there's, like – death and birth and new life, like it's all connected. And it just, I don't know, for me, it's a beautiful metaphor about how God uses all these things. Not that they're good, like, oh, I'm so glad this happened, or not like that, but just the idea that this kind of death, this kind of loss, like if we allow him and kind of like, you know, like the trees, like the leaves surrender to falling to the ground and then look what happens in the spring, right? Tomorrow's first day of spring. And so I feel like there's a wrestling and a kind of surrendering that we can kind of see in nature too, and the seasons, and how I've found comforting knowing I'm in a season right now, and it might suck, and I'm just like trying not to rush through it, and then the next season is going to come. Like, and so this kind of change we can see in the midst of nature. And so I often see God in creation, and I just think it's cool how he's made everything in this way where we can see these patterns and seasons, and then, you know, in the history of the church. And the, like, anyway, so I can just, like, see all these connections. So that's it. Thanks.
Yeah, Peter.
When Jim and I were kayaking, I just had this picture for Dave because the waters were so crazy rough, and all I could see was Jim's hat. And I was like, you know, but sometimes that's all we can see, but we know that there'll be the next wave. So just as an encouragement that sometimes that's all we can see, but we know there's more coming.
Peter?
If I could just typically share something theoretical first that's non-personal and then the personal. Safe to say something theoretical, but I study a lot about attachment theory as it pertains to youth development and parenting. There's three phases in childhood development. Emergence is a child finding their voice and being able to move away from the nest with confidence and strength, knowing that there's security from the nest, much like a fledgling eagle that jumps off the nest. Integration is having mixed feelings, being able to have two feelings at the same time and being able to filter those feelings. This is really good, but this is going on. And integration brings maturity. And the one I want to just remind you of is adaptation. If children don't learn to adapt, they will not grow into maturity. And sometimes as adults, we don't adapt. We stay stuck in the same place. And Neufeld always says to adapt in a child, for children to be able to adapt, they need to feel their tears of futility. Something is not working, and they feel that it's not working and that it's not going to work. They express their emotion and allow that emotion, the tears of futility, to come out. And then they realize, well, Daddy's not going to give me the cookie before bed, so I'll just have to deal with it. I cry about it. I'm sad, but I'll move on. And I'm not going to get a cookie tomorrow night either. And you change. And as adults, I think in our culture, and I know for me too, we don't allow, and Jim talked about this morning, it's so important, is the tears of futility when things aren't working, whether you're 4 years old or 12 years old or 62 years old, things aren't working, to feel the tears of futility and to realize that releasing the tears of futility in the context of people that you love and care for is the only way to adapt. And if you think you're going to change and get out of your stuck place by internalizing and coping and pushing it down, you're not going to change. It will, and Jim talked about the toxicity of emotions that we don't share with other people. And that's why this is beautiful and church is beautiful, because we're in the context of sharing our hearts with each other and sharing our pain with each other. And we know that unexpressed pain, unexpressed emotion creates not only mental health issues, and Jim talked about this too, but also physical issues, physical ailments coming out of pain that is not released. And some of you are internalizers. I tend to wear my heart on a sleeve, but some people I know push emotion down, and Jim talked about this too, and I've seen just over the years of knowing Jim is an internalizer. He pushes things down because to be independent and to be strong and to be capable and sufficient. And the beauty of Jim's growth, as I've known him as a friend, is his ability to release his pain, to release his emotions and his heart and express that. And we can't change unless we share that stuff that we try to cope with and suck it up and be strong. On the personal level, the thing of the CRV with the park, reverse neutral, driving low, and the green neutral. My experience in transition, having retired 6 years ago, this green neutral thing is still going on. And what I feel is expectations from the outside for me, what are you going to do now? What's your next thing going to be? What are you going to take up? How come you're just doing this when it's been really hard for me to go from being in a building with a whole bunch of people every day and having a role and having a colleagues and kids to not having any of that. It's a huge transition for me, and it's really difficult because for Pam and I, for all our lives, we've been public servants, and now to not have that is a huge deal. But what I've come to realize is to be in the green with the neutral, it's okay. And Karen alluded to this too. It's a season. And not to be always comparing myself to other people or thinking I should be doing this, or look at this guy, he's now on the school board, or this guy's doing this and all of that kind of stuff. It's been really hard to just stay in that season of neutral and realize that God does have something in store, but stop comparing yourself to other people. Stop putting expectations on yourself that you should be doing all these amazing things. Just kind of stay in that state for a while. And eventually, you know, I think change will have to happen. I will change. And it's partly going to be because of I realize that, you know, this isn't going anywhere. And I'm in the maze and I'm keep bumping into this wall. And it's not, so I have to turn and go a new direction. I don't know what it's going to be, but, you know, as I say quite often, every day is a gift. It could be a health issue. It could be a new opportunity in something, but to be okay in the neutral phase, and to not compare myself or feel like this outside pressure that you should be doing something because you're changing. So that's just a couple of things. And I want to thank Grace and Jim so much, just maybe on behalf of the Elders Board, that, and to encourage all of you that your gifting and your ministry here is valued, and we want to encourage this where people bring things to the group and it makes the group so much stronger. And anytime a poet lights a candle in front of the room, I'm totally down for that. having taught poetry in school. But thank you so much, Jim and Grace, for what you guys shared with us.
Peter talked about that stage of integration where you can kind of feel two different things. What I've presented here this morning is very simplistic. You know, I've got these levels. What I've experienced is, you know, you can have one facet in disorientation and another facet at the same time in this new orientation. And you've got this, you know, how does that all fit together? And it, you know, it doesn't necessarily. But anyways, just to say, you know, you can feel it. There's more than one layer of things going on, and that just ends up, I guess, complicating things for each of us. And you know, this morning was supposed to be a communion morning as well, and I was looking at communion, the Last Supper, in terms through this lens of orientations, disorientation, new orientations. And if you think about what's going on there, there's several of those happening, a couple of those happening simultaneously. You have Jesus has been talking about his upcoming death, and the disciples are uncomfortable with that language. Jesus talks about, this is my body broken. That's language of disorientation. The pieces. There's the pieces. But then he also goes on and talks about the cup, the new covenant. Here is this new orientation. And so you've got these two in tension with each other. And I think that's so typical of life. We're in these tensions, and we're wrestling with them, and they don't always make sense. But anyways, I throw that out there with communion about these different places. You got the old breaking down, but something new coming. But that old had to pass away for the new one to begin. I'm going to close there. I've got one song that I wanted to do. This is from Josh. Oh, shoot. Just lost the line. Garrels, thank you. It's an old hymn, but he's changed, I think, some of the words and just restructured it a bit. So see if we can get this piece of technology to work there, Andrew.
Cheer up, my brothers. Live. God's bad man thrives in Jesus Christ, cause he loves them both. We're all castaways in need of rope, hanging on by the last threads of our hope. In a house, a mirror full of smoke, confusion, illusions I've seen. But where did I go wrong? I sang along to every chorus of the song that the devil wrote like a piper at the gate, leading my men down to their fate. Some will courageously escape the seductive voice with the heart of faith. While walking the line back home, there's so much more to life than we've been told. It's full of beauty that will unfold and shine like you struck gold, my wayward son. The dead weight burden weighs a ton. I'll go down to the river and let it run, wash away all the things you've done. Forgiveness, alright. Farther along, ooh, know all about it. Farther along, ooh, understand why. So cheer up, my brothers, live in the sunshine. Place left to go, cause I got changed by what I've been shown. There's more glory than the world has known. It keeps me rambling on and skipping like a cat loosed from his stall. I'm free to love once and for all, and even when I fall, I get back up for the joy that overflows my cup. Heaven filled me with more than enough, broke down my levees and my bluffs. Let the flood wash me. And one day when the sky rolls back on us, some rejoice and the others fuss, cause every knee must bow and tongue confess. The Son of God, he's forever blessed. His is the kingdom and we're the guests. So put your voice up to the test. Sing, Lord, come soon. Oh, yeah. Farther along.
That's the hope we hold. Now we know only in part, but someday we shall know fully, even as we are fully known. And so we were people that are not without hope, and that's, I think, a huge, huge blessing. So may you carry that light of hope with you in the days to come, in whatever orientation you are in at this moment. Go in peace.